Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Kyle Mabry is at the controls this morning. Political power rests on the ability of the rulers to meet the basic needs of their subjects. And in the case of the pre-Hispanic Maya, one of those basic needs was water. The classic Maya kings built some rather elaborate systems to store water, to provide for their people, and also to demonstrate that they had the favor of the gods. But there was a time when the rains failed and the rulers lost both their claim to supernatural power and also the authority to govern. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Lisa Lucero. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology here at the University of Illinois. She's been here a relatively short time. Before this, she taught at New Mexico State University. And she, for some time, has been looking at two things particularly closely. And she's authored a book that uses both the things in the title, Water and Ritual, the Rise and Fall of the Classic Maya Rulers. And here we're talking about people, one of the major cultures of Central America. And we'll talk a little bit more about who the Maya are. And she's particularly interested in the way that they manage water. We will talk about that and connections between water and politics, and perhaps also talk a little bit about global climate and politics, and talk a little bit about where we are today, because she's certainly interested in that as well. And we're pleased that she could be here and spend a little time with us this morning. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, 800-222-9455. Any place else, and at any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me.
We should talk a little bit first here about the Maya, and the Maya that you're talking about, because there are still Maya.
Yes.
But the peoples that you're particularly interested in studying, where did they live?
They lived in Guatemala, Belize, parts of Honduras, and parts of southeastern Mexico. They lived in the lowlands and in the highlands, but I focus on the southern Maya lowlands, which is the Batán, Belize, southeastern Mexico.
And what time period are we talking about?
Well, the rulers reached their height of power in the late classic period, which is about AD 550 to 850. And then from 850 to 950, this is when you start to see the abandonment of all of these centers. Hundreds of Maya centers were abandoned, and they were never to be reoccupied again. They still are not occupied to this day.
And at the height that we're talking about, at the period we're talking about, how many, you have a rough sense about how many, what the population was, how many people there were?
Well, that's always problematic in Maya archaeology, because the centers, notice I didn't use the term city, because centers are monumental architecture of public architecture, temples, bar courts, palaces. You don't have your typical city plan of grids and granaries in this and administrative buildings per se. The majority of people lived outside of centers in farmsteads dispersed throughout the hinterlands. And this means that it's very difficult to gauge population. It definitely was higher than what we'd see today. As to how much higher, that is problematic. I mean, for example, the largest site in the Batán or in the Maya area is Tikal. And archaeologists have estimated from anywhere from 20,000 to 80,000 people in that area alone. And remember, there are hundreds of centers. So you extrapolate that to the other hundreds of at centers of various sizes, we're talking several million people.
And I suppose that probably a lot of people only have this very vague notion about the indigenous cultures of the Americas before Europeans got here. They know that there were very significant cultures, some cases very large populations, very large population centers, and also the thing that they think about is monumental architecture. Big temples and big buildings and very complex and very beautiful cities. These are the places that now people go and visit. These are the places where these people left and then never went back. What about, just talk a little bit about the Maya and what is it that's special about them?
Well, one of the special things about the Maya is that they achieve these amazing things in a tropical environment, with humid, extreme conditions of wet seasons and dry seasons. You've got parasitic diseases that could not support livestock, thus large game, I should say. Thus, you don't have roads, you don't have carts, you don't have metals in the southern Maya lowlands. Thus, everything that was built was based on human labor and stone tools. So all those monuments of architecture, all those buildings were built just stone tools and human labor. And also, again, dealing with extreme conditions of wet and dry seasons, wet, floods, hurricanes and the like, dry season, extreme drought. There are 4 months during the dry season when it does not rain at all. You could be surrounded by this lush environment and die of dehydration if you do not know where to find water, and that was critical. But also, they have some of the richest tropical soils in the world. However, they are dispersed. Unlike in other complex societies where you get the development of these state systems along rivers, such as ancient China, the Andean, Egypt, the Tigris, Euphrates, and the like, where you get these huge farming settlements and towns and cities developed, the Maya area, since the soils, the rich soils for agriculture are dispersed, so are the people. And this goes back to the issue of the centers versus cities and why it's so difficult to gauge the population size. But these people adapted, the ancient Maya, as the Maya do today, adapted living in this environment across this dispersed landscape.
Mm-hmm. See, you touched on something I think is very interesting. I think probably some people will think is counterintuitive. That is, in a tropical area that water, access to water, having enough water would be an issue. You would think, well, it's tropical. And the idea that there would be a very significant part of the year when it wouldn't rain at all,
yes,
which would make water management, making sure that when it did rain, you got what there was to be had, and you had some way that you could store and dole that out so that you would have a reliable supply of water so that you could, for agriculture and other human needs. I'm sure that some people would say, well, that's sort of surprising that in a tropical place that would be such a big issue.
Yes, it is sort of counterintuitive because there is lots of water if you know where to find it. However, the largest Maya centers, and translate that as the largest, most powerful rulers, Caracol, Naranjo, Calakmul, and Tikal, none of these centers are located near lakes or rivers or permanent water sources. However, they're located in areas with large plots of these excellent soils. So you've got lots of great soils, but no lakes or rivers. How do you compensate for that? Well, and when you're quarrying limestone, the limestone bedrock, to make these monumental architecture, you can also quarry out reservoirs. So these reservoirs are literally found right next door to temples. And you can almost conceive as Maya temples as toll houses or ticket booths for water. You want access to water during the dry season? Well, you help maintain these buildings. You help build the palaces and the ball courts. In return, we will, of course, reach the gods to provide enough rain. We will fund and sponsor huge ceremonies and ball games and the like. We will, once in a while, sacrifice rulers we capture to show how powerful we are. So they did provide basic as well as ritual and spiritual needs. Hmm. Now, one of the interesting things about water management is keeping water clean for 4 months. And they understood and applied the basic principles of the wetland, natural wetland biosphere, a certain mix of macrophytic and hydrophytic plants, parasites, bacteria, all work together to keep water clean. And the sign of this clean water was the presence of Nymphaea amphla, which is a kind of water lily. And water lilies are very sensitive plants, can only grow in clean, still water, not too much calcium, not too much algae. So they indicate even we can drink the water. So, and water lilies are part of royal insignia. They have water lily headdresses, you have water lily people, you have water lily this and water lily that. So it's a very interesting, they adapted quite well, not only in terms of surviving, but also for political survival.
Mm-hmm. See, now this also gets at the other really interesting question. That is, the way you describe these societies here, we have, they're based on agriculture, which is very labor intense. We've got a lot of people working to grow food. And then we have these public structures, temples, palaces, the systems that are there for storing and using water that take a lot of labor to work, to build these things. And then you have this stratified society where you have essentially, you have royals and you have commoners, and I'm sure that there are other sorts of fine distinctions there. But then that gets to this old question, well, why should the people who are doing the work do that work and at least give their labor and the fruit of that labor, give it over to these people that are on the top, You know, so you'd have to ask, well, okay, what sort of function do they perform? How do they justify their existence if their job is to be on top? And it does indeed have to do with the, with this connection between, you know, the natural environment and the gods, and who's the intermediary, and who, and then how do they manage to get credit when things are going great? How do they, is they manage to get credit for that?
Well, I'll answer this in various ways. As a backdrop, I will explain a little. I mentioned before that the soils are dispersed, thus the farmers are dispersed. And the most labor-intensive time for agriculture is during the rainy season. So everyone, you have basically independent communities. During the dry season, this is the agricultural downtime. So this is when building programs, and this is when they would need water. So the public architecture, not only are they trying to attract supporters to build and support them, but they're also competing among the centers. And so, again, this distinguishes these Maya centers as public. You know, I call them neon, you know, prehistoric neon signs in terms of this public architecture trying to attract them. Mm-hmm. And they attract them through prosperity through their family, their retinue, their priests, their buildings. Of course, it's a catch-22. You need the support of people to show how prosperous you are. But it's a continual negotiation thing. It's almost a seasonal competitive arena. So you have centers, and that's why if you read the hieroglyphic record, you have all of these events that discuss where you have the rise of rulers at one center versus another. And it's almost yearly. I mean, Tikal and Kalak Mul predominate, but you always have these other centers trying to compete them. And it does have to do with the amount of people the local area can support the agricultural land. And it has to do with water management, availability of clean drinking water during the dry season. That's these reservoirs. So you've got great land, then you need the water. It's the rulers who provide the water, and it's the ceremonies that people participate in that they witness where the rulers are performing these rituals to water rites, sun rites, rites to show to the maize god, the rain god Chak, the sun god. We don't know the names of all of these gods. This Chak is one of the few names of gods we do know. So there's always this sense of performance.
Well, see, then this again is a very interesting idea that the ruled might actually be in some position to choose who it is they were going to submit themselves to, and that among the rulers there would be competition for subjects, and that the subjects would then be looking at the potential rulers and looking at how they were doing and what kind of how they lived and what kind of buildings they had and what sort of prosperity level that they would have, and say, and would maybe make comparisons and say, well, if these guys over here, look at how well they're doing, look at how magnificent their buildings are, look at how magnificent they are, that must mean that these people have the favor of the gods. So those would be good people for us to go with.
Exactly.
I think it's very interesting that they would actually be able to choose, and they would look over at another center and say, well, those people, they don't look like they're doing all that well. So maybe they don't have the favor of the gods. So rather than going with these other people, they will look at this other city and say, well, they're doing very well. Let's go over and we'll go work for those people.
Exactly. And I should say outright that not all my archaeologists agree with my model, which I guess is not surprising. But also there's actually some evidence for this. For example, in the latter part of the 6th century, the rulers from Caracal defeated Tikal's rulers twice. And what you see after this is a relatively dramatic drop in population around Tikal. We use ceramic styles to indicate this. And you see this dramatic increase in and around Caracal in the space of 100 years. I mean, we don't have enough fine-tuned chronology to say other than that. But you see these secondary, and also in the hieroglyphic inscriptions, you see a hiatus, for example, in the Tikal inscriptions, where for 150 years you don't see any inscriptions, any building programs, and then they rebuild again. And that could be, I argue, this is when you get these fluctuations in competitive rulers at different centers.
Yeah.
So I do think people did have a choice, and I use a phrase in the book, they voted with their feet.
Very interesting. Our guest this morning is Lisa Lucero. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology here at the University of Illinois. She's authored a book that explores this territory. The title of her book is Water and Ritual, The Rise and Fall of Classic Maya Rulers, and it is published by the University of Texas Press. She is interested in the archaeology of the Maya, has done a lot of work on pre-Hispanic Maya water management, has done work at a place called Yalbac.
Correct.
In Belize. Belize is on the Atlantic coast of Central America. And in fact, I think in May next month, you'll be taking some U of I students there to spend some time doing work there.
Yes, I'm running a 6-week field season, a field school in Belize, which is part of my research project, looking at the ritual architecture at Yalbac, and then apply what we learned to the broader scales of. So I'm always focusing on the ritual aspects of architecture and then how it ties into political systems.
Yeah. All right. We have a caller here. Someone who is listening, it says here they're in Maryland, so we'll go there. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Hello.
Yes.
Yes, I was curious. I actually graduated from the University of Illinois, and I'm glad to have this new professor on board. I was just curious about her theory about the water access. Southern lowlands in the Maya area had these pockets of water called aguadas, and it was very seasonal. But in the northern lowlands, you have the underground rivers and all of the aquifers. I was wondering if you had any thoughts about the fact that the northern lowlands may have had the highest settlement density, a lot of people living up there, and the fact that the northern cities might have lasted a bit longer than the southern lowlands where she works.
That's an excellent question. The northern lowlands has a slightly different settlement history. Number one, they did have a longer occupation history there, but much fewer people. The soils up there are much thinner. And it also has a slightly different topography in the sense that the water table is high enough to fill what we call cenotes, which are sinkholes. And so these cenotes are filled by the water table. It's different from the southern Maya lowlands because of where the water table is much too low. So all the water in the southern Maya lowlands comes from surface, from the rainfall, basically, and some springs. The northern lowlands, yes, you have a lot of water tables. There's also much less annual rainfall there. So, but you do get a spike in population after the centers are abandoned. So when a long-term drought impacted the southern Maya lowlands, at the end of the late classic period, between about 750, 850, when you start to see, many did go north, but they also went west, south, and east, well, as far as east they could go. Did I answer your question?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you very much.
Right, thank you. Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, you talked a little bit about how in this particular, the southern Maya lowlands, very rich, productive agricultural soil, but water is an issue because there are some times when it really rains and then there are times that it doesn't rain at all. And that one of the things that these people did was that they organized a system. They built waterworks. They built ways to store the water so that it would be available for human consumption and for irrigation all throughout the year. So if you ask the questions, well, what do the rulers provide? There was something very concrete they provided, access to potable, clean, potable water. I want to ask you about the other part of this, though, about the ritual part. How does you can see the provision of something very important and concrete like water, something you cannot survive without? Now, this is very important. If someone can provide that to you, then maybe you're going to say, okay, I'll bow my head and I'll give you some of my crops and, you know, do whatever else is required. The ritual part seems a little less sort of concrete. You can understand how that can be important. Maybe it satisfies a different kind of a need.
Yes. Well, ritual and politics, as we know today, go hand in hand. I mean, I was just listening to the radio the other day where all the presidential candidates were being asked, you know, how they would incorporate God into their plans, you know, and so that's you know, religious beliefs, but it's expressed through ritual, through these habitual activities. In the Maya area, there's actually a lot of concrete evidence, not only in the inscription, the iconography, but one of the things Maya architecture is famous for, from the smallest house to the largest temple, is the onion skin architecture. It's layer upon layer, like a mini tell, like in the Middle East, you know, there's layer upon layer. Mm-hmm. In the Maya area, they would rebuild at certain points. It wasn't just a time of maintenance. It was because somebody died. Not just anybody in the family, but somebody. They would bury them in their house floors, and they would have a funerary rite. And then they would destroy the house to rebuild anew. That also is termination. They would burn, smash things, and literally start anew. And then they would build a new house right on top. And then they would dedicate the new house. They would put whole items, unburned and unbroken, underneath the floors. So the structures, the depositional history of these are actually ritual behaviors. And since the smallest house and the largest temple are the same, they're conducting the same rite. So it's an integrative tool. When the king is conducting funerary rites, termination rites, and dedicatory rites, just like everybody else, that's a connecting tool, except they're doing it for a public audience. Whereas a commoner farmer is doing it for his family and maybe some of the community members, the ruler and emerging elites are doing it for larger and larger groups of people. And they provide food, and they provide, and this is when they start integrating them. This is when they start to show them that they can not only fund these large ceremonies, they can fund them, but because clearly not only do they, but their ancestors have these closer ties to the gods. Look at their prosperity. And when you see increasing population, when you start to see a need for greater reliance on others, when you become increasingly independent, all of this comes together. So you have the integrative tools of ritual, these performances, these integrative rites, these ceremonies. And then you have the actual basic need of water. Together, they're a very powerful tool. Cross-culturally, you find this case throughout the world. I doubt we will ever see an atheist president. I mean, the act of taking a photograph of the presidential candidate coming out of a church is just very telling. And it also demonstrates that ritual is still as important as it was for thousands of years.
Mm. Let's talk with someone else here in Champaign. This is line one. Hello.
Hi. I was wondering, you addressed earlier there's about 150-year difference, or about 150 years where one culture, one of the centers, had kind of faded away. You didn't find records. What was an average lifespan there? What was, like, how many generations were we seeing there throughout that 150 years?
The typical occupation history at all centers are, where you get the centers are 300 BC through about AD 900. So the 150-year period of the hiatus was only a political hiatus. I mean, there were still people and farmers and elites living nearby, but in terms of bragging rights, in terms of being able to acquire enough laborers and supporters to build and maintain some of the structures, that's what was missing. The people were still doing their everyday seasonal needs, probably still accessing the reservoirs. But it took a while for them to be able to, the rulers, that is, to be able to have bragging rights. They're still there. They just did not have the power to do much about it.
All right, thank you. Do you know what about their average, about how long the average lifespan was for the people?
Well, bioarchaeology is a relatively new field, and it's not my specialty. However, I would guess, based on other prehistoric cultures, approximately 40, 45.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you. So, and if I'm to understand it, the dates here we're talking about a people who essentially lived in this area for about 1,200 years?
Well, that's just the centers. We had farming communities for many centuries before that. I mean, the area was occupied, you know, for at least by 2000 BC, if not earlier. We have archaic, which is hunting and gathering, and then you get farming village. And archaic, unfortunately, the type of material evidence is very sparse. Plus, people often build over earlier sites because people always choose the best areas to camp or to build smaller things. So a lot of that stuff is underneath the huge monumental architecture.
Well, I guess the question I'm going for is that we have these people who were living in these centers for a significant amount of time and did do this very significant building, left behind these enormous structures, and left. What happened?
Well, I should first explain that it was the kings who disappeared, not the people. I mean, many people did leave. There's increasing evidence from late core data, from ice core data, from many kinds of indirect evidence that there was a long-term drought. Now, one of the things about this area as well, as there were not extensive, huge irrigation systems. There were small-scale ones, Outside of reservoirs, though, we had a few check dams, terraces, but nothing on the massive scale as you see elsewhere. In other words, these farmers were rainfall dependent. They had to plant at the right time, predicting when the rains would start. If they planted too early, the seeds wouldn't grow. If they planted too late, they would rot. I mean, it was a very predictive science. And of course, this is something also the rulers tied into. So imagine, even if the rain started a couple weeks later or a couple weeks earlier, that sets off the entire agricultural schedule. And when you're relying, if your staples of maize, beans, and squash are relying on this, it's going to have an impact in terms of health, fertility. So you've got these issues. But if it's longer than a few years, who do you blame? Who do we blame for the economic problems now?
People on top.
Yeah.
People who before took credit when things were good.
Exactly. It's the same thing. We have political rallies today. And just like then, the political rallies. And what I think they did was, and I think this is something we can learn from the past, is that they started to perform more and more ceremonies, using up stores of food, using up stores of capital, anything, in order to try to reach the gods. So they, and instead of trying something new, they were trying the tried and true traditional means, which just don't work. People don't like change. And in terms of the ritual, it was a gradual increment of how rulers and emerging leaders integrated people through conducting the same rites. People like tradition. People like, you know, it worked in the past, why it's going to work now. And it didn't work. So people blamed the rule and started. Some farmers left the area. Some just remained in their farmsteads. And since a lot of people left, there was now enough water in these small aguadas that earlier caller mentioned, natural sinkholes that are fed by water, rainfall. So I think over the long course, it's just, we're not going to contribute to you. You've failed us. You've claimed closer connections to the gods. The rains aren't coming at the right time, or there's too much or not enough. Goodbye. We are no longer going to build your palace, build your temples, build your ball court, maintain your plaza floors, maintain your fields, maintain you at all. And it's bad enough where some of us actually have to leave altogether. So kings disappeared. People did not.
Yeah. And apparently also what happened, and I don't know if it happened at that point or it happened before, that people, perhaps other groups of people came together and said, well, maybe the gods will. Well, if the gods have abandoned those people, well, maybe they'll talk to us. Maybe they'll do something for us. So we'll build our own temple. We're not going to build a temple for those people. The gods don't care about them anymore. Let's all us get together, and it could, you know, who knows who it is we could be talking about. Groups of people who said, well, we'll build our own temple.
Well, I think there was enough impact on the health where you did see a depopulation or lessening population. So if one has a first choice, the first choice is to not pay any taxes, to not be beholden to anybody. But of course, that doesn't last long. What you do get in the northern lowlands, at Chichen Itza and other sites, and they had been occupied in the classic period, but in the post-classic, after the southern Maya lowland centers were abandoned, you do see the building of these temples, no longer sponsored by rulers, but devoted to what they should have been in the first place, devoted to gods. The temple, you start to see the appearance of the temple of Kukulkan, the feathered serpent, Quetzalcoatl, all the same terminology. You see temples devoted to warrior societies. You know, you see a de-emphasis on individual rulers. You see an emphasis on joint rulership. You see a de-emphasis on gods that were associated in the classic period with royalty. So you do get this shift in the iconography and the inscriptions, in elite iconography, I should say, where you de-emphasize the ruler and emphasize joint rulership and trying something new. And that worked until the Spanish came. Not Chichen Itza. By then, they moved to Mayapan and other centers. And there are still descendants of these rulers living in the Yucatan today.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Lisa Lucero, she is a professor, associate professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois, and is interested in the Maya. And we've been talking a little bit about some of the work that she has done. If you're interested in reading her book, it's Water and Ritual, The Rise and Fall of Classic Maya Rulers. And the publisher on the book is the University of Texas Press. She's also interested in other sorts of things, including the connections between religion and architecture?
Yes.
Isn't that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL, 9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Can we now take some of what we've been talking about, and in some ways that you already have done this, but take some of what you've been talking about and drag it with us to the present and talk about perhaps the, you know, how it is that looking at what the Maya did, and perhaps in response to environmental change, can we learn anything by looking at this?
I think we can. As to exactly what, that's something we're still working on. I do think we have to make dramatic changes. We cannot rely on techniques that worked in the past. And you're starting to see that with the adoption of, you know, natural ways of cleaning water. I mean, there's a lot of things people are doing. But another thing, too, I think to convince people that climate change has a major impact on society is to take a different tact, learning from the past by just talking about the past. My colleague here in the English department, Gillen Wood, and I have been organizing a conference for April 09 called Climate Change, Human Costs, where we tell the human side of the story through time, throughout the world, from recent history to ancient history, to see if we can learn from the past. Because everyone agrees with that adage, history repeats itself. But that is not necessarily a good thing. So how can we avoid repeating ourselves in the cases where it didn't work and repeat ourselves when it did work? And we have to distinguish that, because people do have a tendency to look on the past as all good. And that is, I think, one of the problems we have to just move away from by learning from the past. And that means trying dramatically new things, whether it be ideological, whether it be economic, social, or scientific. We have to get away from clinging to the past.
How was it that with this particular issue, water management, was something that you became interested in?
Well, one of my professors, Dr. Annabelle Ford, I went to UCLA and she was at UC Santa Barbara. She got me interested in this. And also working down there, you really start to appreciate. We have to go during the dry season. And, you know, just being surrounded by this incredible environment, the orchids and the animals, the toucans, the birds, and just being burdened by all the water we have to carry, because we, one, exudes a lot more sweat than in temperate zones. And a lot of, you know, you lose so much water. And just appreciating where you understand. And then learning, the more and more I learned about the Maya, and just learning to appreciate their survival in this environment. And most of my excavation assistants are Maya. And so the fact that they grew up in the same environment and they understand the medicinal qualities, and you just piece it all together. And then the tropical environment is an amazing environment in and of itself. But surviving in it is entirely another story. And the fact that they did for millennia quite successfully is an amazing feat. And basically, when the more research I did, the more I realized that water was key, understanding how it was distributed, the rainfall dependency, and providing clean water. I mean, 4 months of standing water in reservoirs, you got to keep it clean. And they understood how to do that. And today, civil engineers are applying traditional techniques to try to cleanse water without using chemicals. So they're reverting back to this. And in that case, that's a good idea. Mm-hmm. But it does require large-scale issues, but that's another story. So that's how I got into it. And it got me interested in applying the water management issue to broader scales. I've been involved in a UNESCO book project that will be published in 09 that'll be given to major water policymakers throughout the world, where I provide the perspective from lowland Mesoamerica, what we can learn from the past. And scholars from all over the world working in different parts of the world have contributed to this. And so slowly but surely, anthropology and archaeology and history and other social sciences are making headways into a field that is dominated by the hard sciences, who tell us the facts but not how it impacts people. By telling stories of how climate change impacts a family, a community, a town, a village through time and at present, can better explain how climate change impacts society. When you tell stories, the human side of the story, which is the purpose of my current research as well as this upcoming conference, mm-hmm. well, in 09.
Just to clarify something in my mind, maybe I misstated or misunderstood when we're talking about the reservoirs that we're constructing these big population centers. I guess I maybe had said something that wasn't quite right. This was just for human consumption. This wasn't used for irrigation purposes.
Well, the reservoirs were mostly for consumption. The ones especially near the temples and living structures or palaces. But Tikal, for example, is a great example because it's actually on a hilltop. There are lower level reservoirs, and which were used for residences, and then lower levels, which could have been used for fish ponds and some irrigation. But in terms for massive irrigations, you need continual flowing water, you know, and so that's rivers. And since there aren't any rivers or lakes, you know, you rely less on irrigation for agriculture. And some of the reservoirs, yes, especially at the end of the dry season, there were drainage ditches that could have been, you know, flushed down for irrigation purposes, you know, they would be refilled with clean water. But in terms of wide-scale irrigation, no. It's surprising. It's, one of those things that the Maya are known for is the lack of large-scale irrigation systems in the southern Maya lowlands. But again, that these are the largest centers not located near lakes or rivers, where you do see the largest irrigation systems develop, again, in ancient China and Tigris-Euphrates and Egypt, et cetera, et cetera. But without massive amounts of flowing water, you can't have those large irrigation systems.
And that goes back to what you were saying before about if your agriculture is heavily dependent on rain, you'd better be very well tuned to the rhythms of nature, when you're going to get your rain and when you're not, because you've got to get things in, you've got to get your planting in tune with when the rain is going to come. And then, of course, that means that if it goes along that way and everything goes along the way it has, well, that's fine. But if something big happens to change it and you get thrown off, or it doesn't rain at all, or doesn't rain enough, then you're going to have a serious problem.
Exactly, especially if that occurs year after year, even 5 years. I mean, because of the humotropics, they can't store food for very long times. We've done experiments. Archaeologists have done experiments with these chultuns, these underground excavated little areas, but too humid. I mean, you can smoke things, but even smoked, the humidity, the humid environment just eats everything away. So you can't store things for very long. We're talking a couple years at most, unlike in other areas in temperate areas where you can store grains for years. In my area, you cannot. The humid tropics just don't allow it.
Mm-hmm. I guess it does indeed get you thinking about how ingenious people are in the ways of figuring out how to live in particular environments, how these people obviously figured out how for a long time to live very successfully in this particular environment. And I'm sure that took time. It probably took a long time for them to figure these things out, but that they did.
Exactly. I mean, that's amazing to me. And actually, a lot of policymakers throughout the world are actually reverting to some of these traditional techniques because the westernization, the green revolution, just doesn't work in all areas. You know, massive plowing and fertilizers. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. When it doesn't, they end up reverting to traditional techniques.
Yeah. We have about 10, 15 minutes left in this part of, maybe not quite 15 minutes, maybe more like 12 or 13 minutes left in this hour of focus with Lisa Lucero. She is Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about some of the work that she has done on the Maya culture. Questions, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You're interested in doing something more with religious architecture in politics. Talk about that.
Well, I've mentioned before the competition between centers.
Right.
And it got me thinking because a colleague asked me, he works in the Southwest United States, he's an archaeologist, he asked, why do Maya centers have so many temples? And Yalbach, because that's a small center I'm working at, it has 6 pyramid-shaped temples. Were they for different gods? Did different families build them? Were they for different days of the week, different seasons, different astronomical rites? And when it came down to it, we just basically took Maya temples for granted, if you will. Maya temple, enough said. Mm-hmm. And it's only the large ones at the largest centers that have some iconography and inscriptions. And they focus on the ruler who built them, not what it was for. Cross-culturally, you know, different temples are built for different gods. I mean, you look at Champaign-Urbana. There's different churches for different Christian religions, mosques, synagogues, etc. Why not in the Maya area? And then people are always competing for supporters. Why not among the Maya as well? So I'm using architecture. The majority of temples do not have inscriptions or iconography, but I'm looking at architecture to tell us the story, their life history. because cross-culturally, people use different materials for different gods or different kinds of temples, or build the orientation or the number of staircases, the number of terraces, the number of doorways. And so we can, if we can look at the temples, and since there's so many looter's trenches, unfortunately, we can at least get architectural information from these looter's trenches and start looking at the variability among the temples within the center and then among centers themselves. So I'm arguing more and more evidence is coming to light showing that not only is there competition between centers, among centers, different centers, but also within. And the inscriptions give us some indication of that. But temples provide the perfect arena to compete for supporters. They all face these large open plazas. Temples are acoustically engineered as such, where you can just slightly project from way up high and people can hear you down below. So, and if you have the necessary means to support and sponsor large-scale ceremonies, and especially in a downturn, a particularly bad year, you can see where there's new families. There's suddenly the disappearance of one dynasty and the appearance of another. And I'm trying to show through architectural analysis that this is visible. These stories are visible through the architecture itself.
Hmm. Well, when you're, that's, it seems to me to be a considerable challenge if you're confronted with some kind of massive building. So you know this has to be something really important. And that indeed, maybe there's something on there that says, I, the great fill-in-the-blank, built this temple. So you can say, well, okay, you know something about who built it. But then if there's really nothing else written on it that says this is dedicated to this god and this sorts of things, how then do you go about trying to figure out some of those things if in fact that they're not written on the building?
Right. Well, one of the things I'm looking at is, again, I mentioned before, this onion skin architecture. Well, if you can date the phases using ceramics and radiocarbon, if you're lucky, you can look at the different phases. I mean, if one phase dated to the same time period at one temple is a meter thick and another is 3 meters thick, by definition, the one took three times more labor. And also the ritual caches cannot identify. Mm-hmm. The face stones, the size of face stone, the fill type, mortared versus dry core. Dry core is less expensive but much more unstable. And are they sorted fills? I mean, because the pyramid temples are solid structures. There is only rooms up top. That's what the actual temple. The pyramid shape was all solid. I mean, there's a tomb in some of them. But they're all solid. What you fill that with, if it was just local trash and everything, that's less expensive than sorting through river stone or a particular type of stone or bringing it in from further distances. So I'm looking at these kinds of things. The number of face size, like for example, it looks all nice and face, but it's only faced on the superficial side versus if you have the actual time and money, if you will, the wealth, you can face it on all the sides. And that's what I'm looking at, literally the architecture to tell us their story, looking at variability among the temples within and then among centers themselves.
That's an interesting notion that some small things like that could tell you something about maybe the circumstances, what was going on at the time. Were we really in a hurry to build this? Did we really have not that much money? So we made the parts that you could see easily look really nice, right. And the other parts we said, well, that's not so important because that's the backside. Such a small thing could, in fact, tell you a lot, or at least it would give you something that you could build a story on about what was going on at the time, maybe something about who these people were, what kind of pressure they were under to build this thing.
Right. And, I mean, everywhere, people compete through the church, the temple arena. I mean, it provides a perfect arena, a forum, where people could voice their opinions and attract other followers, especially, again, in these downturns. I mean, I'm sure the long-term drought that brought an end to classic Maya rulership in the southern Maya lowlands, I'm sure there were small periods in between where there were problems. And this is where potential competitors could actually say, aren't you tired of supporting this ruler? Come to my temple, kind of thing. Like high priests in Egypt, there was always competition between the high priests and the various temples in Egypt with the pharaohs. That was always a problem. And in the Church of England, I mean, the Pope and Henry VIII, I mean, there's always an issue of church and state. They're definitely related, but they're also, you know, competing with one another, too, for the souls of their supporters, materialized, of course, in their labor.
Yeah. That does, I guess, it causes me to think about how, you know, what the Chinese called the mandate of heaven, how that idea that that's something that you use to justify rulership, and how if it appears that you have it, all right, but when it appears that you've lost it, there's very little that you can do to get it back. When you're lost, you're lost. And then if somebody else can come along and demonstrate that they've got it now, that's a very powerful notion on which to found a dynasty. And people do it over and over again. They
exactly.
may use different sorts of ways to describe what's going on. But that's such a powerful notion. And it does indeed go down to this, to what is a really basic question. It's not something that's sort of obscure and vague. It has to do with providing for basic needs of the people in society. That people are always still looking at rulers one way or another as the people who are going to take care of them and provide for the things that they need.
Right. And the only difference with our own society today is that in many societies it's done within the construct of spiritual needs as well. It's not enough to do the straightforward, I will provide clean water. It has to be more than that. And, you know, you see a mix of that now in a democracy, the supposed separation of church and state. They want to get away from that because that was from the past, and we don't need the spiritual guidance that political rulers could potentially provide, even though, again, that's changing today. You know, people do want that. They want a spiritual leader as well. You know, so, but it comes down to a lot, water and ritual, or economic and ritual. Ritual cannot be separated ever. From politics anyway,
mm-hmm.
whether you call it political rally, even in communist Russia, all the parades they had with Stalin and Lenin and all of the pomp and circumstance, that's ritual, that's ceremony. It's a different ideology, but it's an ideology nonetheless expressed through ritual as an integrative tool with political implications.
Are there more big things that you would want to know about these people? It's some important question that you would really like the answer to?
Well, I would love to know more about their understanding of keeping water clean. I mean, that's something mm-hmm. we face today, open pools of water without, I mean, rivers are kept clean because they're continually moving and things don't have a time to grow, waterborne diseases. I mean, in most cases. In this case, it's standing water. I mean, I can hypothesize all I want of how they kept it clean. And I know the indications of clean water, but actually what they added to the reservoir, what kind of plants they planted, that's something I would really like to know because it has implications for our understanding and keeping water clean. That's a very inexpensive way, you know, from backyard gardens or pools to large-scale water sources. If we can find, and I know they're working on this, to find inexpensive means to keep water clean by using plants. And that's something I would like to learn. Mm-hmm. I think that's really critical for understanding them as well as for applications for today.
And is that a question that's answerable? You think if you keep looking long enough that's something eventually that you would be able to learn? Or is there something that's there just isn't within the record that exists? The answer is just it's not going to be there no matter how hard
I would hope that we can. We can hypothesize. But I will say, for example, at Tikal and Caracol, the archaeologists at Tikal in the 60s dug a well 100 meters deep and gave up and reverted to using the ancient Maya reservoir. And they do at Caracol today. And these reservoirs, in other words, are still functional 1,000 years after having been abandoned. That says something a lot. So perhaps, and there are archaeologists, I mean, there are scientists who argue that the forests we see today the whole forest we see today in the Maya area is actually descendants of a transformed landscape. If that's the case, perhaps the plants, one reason the Tikal reservoir was still useful was because some of the descendants of those plants they used are at least around or nearby or in the reservoir itself. And, you know, eventually what I'd like to do is get a civil engineer involved or some plant specialist where we can look at this.
Well, certainly that would be, as you say, that would be a great thing to be able to know. And that's just as a point of archaeology, but that you could be using the same, if you knew how it was done, you knew what the plants were, assuming the plants still exist, you could use the same technique.
Exactly. I mean, I do know the waters are still clean. We find water lilies all the time. And mm-hmm. I mean, but is it just happens? I mean, do people still understand these processes? It's something I just need to look, you know, into further.
Yeah. Do you, having spent time with these people who aren't here anymore, do you feel that you have a sense for how the world looked to them, how they thought, how they experienced things? Can you in some small way get yourself into the Maya mindset?
That's a tough question, just because their mindset is based on what we know from hieroglyphs, inscriptions, colonial documents in Maya today. Even though they've been impacted by various religious groups, they still practice many, you know, traditional practices and have traditional beliefs. But so much history has passed. You have to, you know, of course, we need to take that into account. But, I mean, for example, when I said the rain god, Chalk, the rain god, it's not so simple as a rain god. There's a light aspect, a dark aspect, a good, a bad. So every god has these different sides to them that we don't really understand. To us, it's a sun god, supreme god. We don't really distinguish other than that. So the fact that every god, no matter how powerful and good it is, has an evil side, has a dark side, has a light side, indicates, you know, a belief system where things are never so simple. I mean, people, there many traditional Mesoamericans have what they call a companion spirit, an animal companion spirit, so similar to what they recently showed in the movie The Golden Compass. I read the book. It's actually quite good. But they're not visible. But there's like various ethnographic films where somebody's ill, and it could be done where a witch has put a curse or something on somebody's way. The companion spirit. So what the shaman does, the curandero, the shaman, the natural healer, he builds a corral around the person's bed if they have an animal companion spirit that would deserve a corral, to try to bring the animal back to this person to make them better again. You know, so we don't have that concept of, maybe we have a concept of a soul, but, you know, we don't think about it that much, maybe on Sundays or Saturdays or just depending. But we don't really think about it on a daily basis and try to heal our soul to heal our bodies, in general, that is. Mm. So there's so many complicated aspects. I don't know if I could do that.
No. Well, if folks are interested in this book that I mentioned a couple of times, the title is Water and Ritual, The Rise and Fall of Classic Maya Rulers by our guest, Lisa Lucera. It's published by the University of Texas Press. She is a professor of anthropology here at the University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.